Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or simply hoping to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. This week, we are going to recognize, honor, acknowledge National Public Schools Week.
Right.
It was a, it sounds like it was a, it's a relatively new thing, but I guess with the, you know, so much attention is being put on public education, on the safety of schools, on, you know, graduation rates and all of these kind of details. The a bipartisan group of individuals from Congress has come together with the, what is it, the American Association of School Administrators.
AASA.
To come up with the National Public Schools Week.
Right.
And that's this week, March 12th through the 16th.
Yes. Public schools have taken quite the bashing.
Yes.
Actually, the bashing started in 1983. With the publication of A Nation at Risk.
Right.
And it was that pamphlet, it wasn't even a book, it was a pamphlet that started the, Americans began to lose faith in their educational system based on that pamphlet.
Right.
The person who wrote it, the group that wrote it, really were critical of the American educational system and that it was falling behind all other countries.
Right.
And so Americans began to lose faith in the public school system.
Right.
And now, as a result of that, it set into motion a number of what are generally called reforms, some of which have been advantageous, others have been disastrous. So we want to look at the public schools, take a sort of an analysis of where we where we've been and where we might go, what some of the current problems are, and maybe some solutions.
Yeah. So we're going to start out today with it with a history. We're going to kind of go through the history of the public education, and then we're going to talk about different aspects of public education throughout some of the major concerns, funding and dropout rates and things like that. Now, as we were talking about before we started recording, much of this is about the United States education system, the education system here in the U.S. Those in the U.K. who listen, it's not as applicable to your education system because as we were trying to research some of that and look into that, you know, for as complicated as our public system, school system is, of course, the public school system over there is just as complicated, maybe more so because it's older. I think I read that the some of the earliest schools are from the you know around 500.
Goes back, right?
Yeah, it's way back.
Fall of the Empire.
Way back when.
Days,
so, so we have a little bit more research to do, a little bit more reading to do to really get a good appreciation of the UK system.
But clearly the system in the UK, the educational policies in the UK have changed dramatically as they have in our country
over
the past 30, 40 years. Massive changes to their system as well.
Yeah, looking at some of the changes that the administration made under Margaret Thatcher. And then over the years how it's evolved and changed is pretty
fascinating. Curiously that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were contemporaries. She was prime minister when he was president. And many of these changes began under those two individuals.
So very interesting. But so this is going to, especially today, is going to focus on the public school system here in the U.S. And we're, it's going to take us back, and I know, you know, this is this is your stuff, man.
It makes me happy all over.
We're going to go back to the 17th century.
Colonial period.
Yeah. So so we go back then because that's sort of when we really begin the idea of educating the population.
Right. And I have to say, full disclosure, I am an advocate. Philosophically, we... I think you and I are advocates of public education.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
The concept that every child should have the opportunity
right.
and that it should be free. Because our education, like most educational systems, began where people had to pay,
right?
Okay, for an education, which meant that only the wealthy could be educated.
Right.
Well, after the revolution occurred in our country, mm-hmm. The thinking of the founding fathers was, well, if we're going to govern ourselves, we better make some accommodation for education.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept of a free education,
mm-hmm.
nothing is free, of course, it's paid for by taxes,
mm-hmm.
Came into being,
right,
as a result of the American Revolution. But so philosophically, we're in favor of it. But during the week, we're going to talk about some of the problems that have arisen
right.
within the system and how we right. might solve some of those problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm going to throw in some things as we're talking that I think are, well, not just me, I know that you are too. Mm-hmm. We're going to throw in some things that I think are common, sort of commonly held misperceptions mm-hmm. about things. And that's going to start today when we talk about a couple of things because right. of, recent events raise concerns about different things, mm-hmm. and I think that it's important right. that we really think about what all of this means.
Right.
So, yep. So when we go back to colonial period, we're mm-hmm. we're talking about times when only a small portion of the population
right.
were really educated,
right.
and that education was pretty pretty confined to particular
mm-hmm.
areas.
Right. Pretty narrow.
So, we're not talking about an education system. In anything like what we have today.
No, we're not. And, it's helpful when you think about, in order to understand where education is today
mm-hmm.
and why we're doing what we're doing, it's helpful to go back and see where it came from.
Right.
And if you can trace its heritage, so you go back to the beginning, and in our country, unlike England, which goes back to before the fall of the Roman Empire,
mm-hmm.
goes certainly part of the Roman Empire, so
yeah.
that's, so we go back to about 1600. I mean, that's mm-hmm. when we can date our history. So we're brand new by
right.
comparison. And so if we go back and look at how it has evolved over time,
mm-hmm.
that's one way to understand the system. A second way to understand the system is to understand what laws have been passed
right.
that we have to live under.
Mm-hmm.
All of everything we do in our country, in one way or another, goes back to some law,
right.
some law that Congress or a state legislature has passed. And the federal government over time has become more and more involved
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
Education. And if you understand what those laws are, you'll have a better appreciation for why things happen the way they do.
And some of that involvement has met with criticism from a lot of people. And there's a movement, a stirring of concern that, part of what's wrong with education is that it is so closely wed to the federal government and that, the funding and all that, and that, there are those who are advocates of privatizing
right.
public education.
That's right. That would be one
right.
extreme.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and then you have, of course, you have individuals who sort of go towards the other end of the extreme,
right.
Somewhat similar to like what Bernie Sanders talked mm-hmm. about in his presidential candidacy run mm-hmm. to become a candidate, where he was talking about extending free education through college.
Right.
So you have sort of these two
mm-hmm.
broad versions.
Two broad versions. Yeah, that the federal government should be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe completely involved, that have a national curriculum,
mm-hmm.
and national federal taxes paying for everybody's education,
right.
to no federal involvement at all. So,
right.
like everything else, you have these two extremes,
mm-hmm.
and the answer is probably somewhere in the middle.
Right.
Okay. But and that's what we talk about. We are advocates of a system that offers everybody an opportunity.
Right.
If you want it and if you can do the work, you should have the opportunity, and you shouldn't have to pay for it, because
right.
if your parents can't pay, then you're going to be at a distinct disadvantage,
right.
and you're going to create a class system.
Right.
And the founding fathers that's the very thing the founding fathers wanted to prevent,
right.
was developing a class system of inherited wealth that existed in Europe.
Right.
Inherited privilege,
mm-hmm.
which existed in Europe. And after our revolution, the founding fathers said, we have to build a different system.
Right.
so that we don't get into inherited privilege.
Right.
And so the public schools were one way to do that.
Right. Now, I found it interesting that, you know, we often, people who talk about the involvement of the federal government in some of these different things, whether it's education or other things, often revert back to the founding fathers.
Right.
And I find it interesting that, you know, Thomas Jefferson, I think, would be considered one of the
George Washington,
fathers.
Ben mm-hmm. Franklin.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson, you know, he was a proponent of a public education system
right.
that was funded by tax dollars
right.
and supported through the through that form of government,
mm-hmm.
But it failed.
Right.
He didn't get passed and everything, and so it was another 100 years or so
right.
before we really started getting into what we right. would consider a public education system.
Yeah, it was about the 1830s that, mm-hmm. that it really began. So, but Jefferson and Washington and Franklin, all the founding fathers, mm-hmm. acknowledged that we needed to have an educated electorate. If you're going to make intelligent decisions,
right.
you have to teach people how to read, you have to educate
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first school was 1635.
Right.
It was the Boston Latin School, and it still exists. That school is still
That's
in
amazing.
Existence. Yeah, the Boston Latin School. Now, the first taxpayer-supported school was just a few years later, it was in 1639. So
mm-hmm.
Boston Latin, people had to pay for it. Because in those years, most schools were funded by the people in the town.
Mm-hmm.
They would either pay tuition, or they would pay the teacher, or they would let the teacher sleep room and board.
Right.
You know, if I had a big house, I would let the teacher stay in my house, and we would provide room and board. Mm-hmm. And so in one way or another, you had to pay for it. The first law that was ever passed was
mm-hmm.
in 1642.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that if a village had 50 families, they had to have an elementary school. And
mm-hmm.
if they had 100 families, they had to have elementary and high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so the laws began coming very, very early in our country. And we've
yeah.
already talked about the founding fathers wanting to have an educational system. Jefferson wanted an educational system based on merit. He
mm-hmm.
said, throw everybody in there, and those who can handle the work and do the work and show themselves to be scholars and capable of learning would rise to the top, and
mm-hmm.
they would become natural leaders. There are some other ways that he phrased it, such
mm-hmm.
as scraping the cream off the trash
right.
and that sort of stuff, but we don't need to get into that. So until the 1830s, education is really these village-based
right.
efforts
right.
to at least make people read, and most of all, to read the Bible.
Right.
I mean, that was much
right.
of the focus. And much of this happened in New England because New England was the most populous
right.
part of the country at that
mm-hmm.
time. The South was far less populated, and education
mm-hmm.
occurred mainly by tutors, and we hadn't moved west yet.
Right.
And so most of this is concentrated in New England.
Right.
And that's where you have these Harvard and Yale and all these early universities, early prep schools like Deerfield and Choate and Andover and those places.
Right.
So education gets concentrated in New England and then spreads from there. But the common schools, what we now consider public schools, we have to go way up to the 1830s
right.
before they start to appear.
Yeah. And then we start getting some other names that we recognize,
right.
like Horace Mann
right.
From Massachusetts, who really, I guess you could say, pioneered.
He really did.
The idea of what we, of almost the common education
right.
model,
right.
Where you know, every student goes to school, every student is
right.
getting a basic education,
mm-hmm.
and we're working to assure that there are schools available for all students.
That's right. And it's his idea. He was the Secretary of Education
mm-hmm.
in Massachusetts in the 1830s. And he borrowed this model from Prussia.
Right.
They had what were called common schools in Prussia. And he said, we need to have the same thing here, where we just provide an education to everybody should
right.
have equal opportunity. And that really begins the American tradition
right.
of a free education at taxpayer expense
right.
for any student who wants to go to school.
Right.
And that began this process of 1830s and 40s and 50s
mm-hmm.
until almost the present day, up
yeah.
into the 1950s, the idea of public schools
right.
providing education.
Right. Yeah, and so it was in the 1950s that mm-hmm. we And the other part I think that came about around the time of Horace Mann is the idea that, because this is going to be relevant as we get into more recent times, is the idea that the high schools prepared students who are going to go to college.
And that's so important because in these years, we'll teach you the rudiments of reading and arithmetic and maybe writing.
That's why we call elementary school primary.
Right.
Primary school.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's right. Elementary.
And we call the other secondary because if you did well there and you went to secondary education, that was in preparation for post-secondary, which
that's
is
right.
college.
And that's a key provision is that high schools were meant to prepare you for college. If you weren't going to college, you didn't need a high school education.
Right.
You were going to go to work somewhere and you didn't need all those courses. So most people went through elementary school. And then at that time, it was before the concept of a whole junior high school or middle school came up. You didn't even need that. So maybe you'd go to fifth grade or sixth grade or seventh grade. Sometimes they went to eighth grade, depending on the state you lived in. And then you dropped out unless you planned to go to college.
Right.
Well, the only people who could go to college in those days were the wealthy.
Right.
So most of these high schools were populated by well-to-do and college-bound students.
Right.
So it was a very homogenous, high-achieving group of students until after World War II.
Right. And those who dropped out, it's not even really dropped out. Those who completed primary education.
Right.
They then went to work in either the family business, the family farm, or through apprenticeships.
Or factories,
right.
which were booming at that time.
Right.
And so there were places for them to go,
Unlike
today, where if you don't, you don't have those factory jobs, you don't have those entry-level positions.
Right.
So we start with these common schools, and then by 1918, every state in the Union, there weren't 50 then, there were 40-some states in the Union have compulsory education laws.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now children have to be in school, most states, until they're 16.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was as early as 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get into more recent times,
right.
and that would be the 1950s. From 1950s until the 1990s, it's generally called the era of equality, educational equality, because this is where we see desegregation, the inclusion of children with handicapping conditions, women with Title IX. And so we see this push to broaden, open up the public schools to a larger audience. So we've gone from these elite prep schools. We went from high schools that prepare students for college to opening up broadly to many more students.
Right.
Okay. So again, that's going to change how education is delivered.
Right.
And what the challenges are. And as you've already intimated, one of the challenges is, what do we do with all these kids in high school who aren't going to go to college?
Right.
And we haven't made accommodations for them yet.
Right. Because that continues to be the model.
That's right.
That is that high school prepares you for college.
That's right.
If you're going to be an electrician, I'm not sure that you need biology or some of these other things.
Or,
right.
You know, it has absolutely no relevance to your life.
Right. Right. And I had this discussion. And this is where throwing in some of the extra stuff is that I was having this discussion with somebody the other day because, part of what we have historically told kids who say, why do I need to learn this? Mm-hmm. Why do I need to study this? And we say, well, it makes you a well-rounded person.
Right.
It makes you a well-informed person. That's almost a mute argument now because, you can learn anything you want to know on YouTube.
That's right.
You
don't need to go through a school
to
get that information.
Right.
And that's a huge difference.
Right. I mean, Shakespeare is available to anyone who goes to Google and types in Shakespeare, and you can get, almost everything unabridged.
And you're going to learn what you want to learn about Shakespeare.
Right.
If you want to learn just who the heck is this guy
and
when did he live, or do you want to really understand
him? Right.
Whatever level you want to go, the internet will provide it.
Right. And so as we as you said, you know, we have this ongoing evolution mm-hmm. of the education system to include Title IX for women, to include desegregation for mm-hmm. minorities, for you know, the Americans with Disability Act and Individuals with Disability Education Act that right. allows handicapped mm-hmm. individuals to be educated in the public school system,
right.
And so over the decades, we have these. It becomes more and more inclusive,
mm-hmm.
but the underlying model expectations That's remain. Right.
The foundation, the framework, right. the skeleton
right.
of high school as preparation for college remains.
Right,
and so you have all these students who are forced to take algebra and geometry and right. English literature and biology and mm-hmm. other sciences. They're not going to use them. Mm-hmm. They don't need them. They have no relevance to their lives. And that generates dropouts. And it right. generates behavior problems because those kids don't want to be in these classes.
Right. And so we're going to, as the week progresses, and you know, you're sitting there listening to this thinking, why in the world do we need this history lesson? It's because it's going to be relevant for everything else we talk about this week.
That's right. Because from 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, right. you desegregate schools. Mm-hmm. So now you have, how do you resegregate a school
right.
with all the racial animosity that existed then mm-hmm. and that continues? So the public schools had to make this massive change of mm-hmm. incorporating students of color. Then that was in 54. Then in 1972, you have Title IX. So mm-hmm. now it's, let's broaden the opportunities for women.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1973, you have no child, you have
Individuals
with Disabilities Education Act. And now you have students with handicapping conditions.
Right.
And now you have to incorporate them. When mm-hmm. I taught in the 70s and 80s, you weren't expected, the regular classroom teacher wasn't expected to manage children with special needs.
Right.
And so they were taken out of your classroom mm-hmm. and put in special classrooms.
Right.
Well, by 1985,
right.
Madeline Will, who was Secretary of Education in the Reagan administration, said, no, we shouldn't be taking these kids out.
Mm-hmm.
We should include them
mm-hmm.
in the regular classroom.
Right.
And so then we have inclusion.
Right.
So now the regular classroom teachers are expected
mm-hmm.
to be able to handle students with handicapping conditions.
So there's not much more training.
We don't give them any more training. We just say, do the best you can,
right.
or we expect you to do the best you can with
right.
these students. And yet we're not providing them with the training.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2001, we have No Child Left Behind, which really puts the full force of the government behind educational progress.
Right.
And schools now get rewarded or punished
right.
if their students are not making a certain amount of progress.
That began the era of accountability.
Accountability. And that's the important word, is accountability. And that we're living under that today.
Right.
Even 15
right.
years later, 16, 17 years later.
Yeah.
We're still living in the area of accountability.
Right.
And then following the area of accountability
uh-huh.
is the era of choice.
Right.
And that's the other thing that we're living. So today we have accountability. You better produce. And
mm-hmm.
that's what schools are feeling, that
mm-hmm.
pressure. It comes from state legislators who are saying, you have to show us results,
mm-hmm.
era of accountability. But at the same time, we have the era of choice.
Right.
And now people are demanding more choice in their public schools.
Right.
All of these things are creating vastly different circumstances
right.
and major challenges
right.
to how education is delivered and received.
Which is very interesting because just kind of tying back to what we said at the beginning, as we were looking at some of the history of the British or
yes.
the United Kingdom based education system, that sounds somewhat similar, pretty similar to what Margaret Thatcher did
right.
in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
where she and her the administration at the time promoted and passed a law that made schools mm-hmm. compete with one another.
Right.
And so those schools that were doing really well, you know, they kept and were able to retain and attract strong students.
The best and brightest.
Whereas those schools who were not doing so well, you know, they were forced to either change or improve or close.
And we're going to talk excitedly and enthusiastically about this concept of creating a two-tiered school system. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear from our friends in the United Kingdom about how that system has worked there, because right. I suspect that it's similar.
Yeah.
When you talk about attracting customers, mm-hmm. when students are thought of as customers,
right.
then you want to attract the best and brightest, which means you have to have some mechanism to get rid of those who are underperforming mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. who are getting in the way right. of students' performance. So I would be very interested in knowing how the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. How educators in the UK are managing that, because it is a huge problem in our country.
Absolutely. So, all right. Any more history?
Good. No, we're good. No?
So we're gonna kind of dig into some of this stuff in different specific mm-hmm. topics right. as we go through the week. But all of it is based upon this general foundation of how our education system has evolved over time mm-hmm. and what that means for some of the current policies and practices. So we'll get into that.
It's going to be an interesting week.
It is. So yep. Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid. Thanks for sharing this episode of the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you will find all of our previous podcasts and much more. We would be honored if you would become a patron through patreon.com, where any donation you can manage will go to the development and creation of more content. Just visit patreon.com/themental breakdown for more information. Thanks again for listening, have an awesome day, and we look forward to being back in your feed tomorrow morning.